Hey everyone, welcome to the 9th episode of Wild True FM, recorded on the 4th of February, 2018. Wild True FM is a podcast about random, hopefully interesting tidbits from technology, programming, entertainment, and whatever other stuff we decide to throw at you. Your hosts today are Kenneth Love,
Sam Rose,
and Daniel Lamond.
So, due to weird scheduling things, Mike's not going to appear in this episode, but he'll still be editing it, so it will still be amazing.
Completely my fault. I'm sorry.
And before we blame Mike, let us just say weird scheduling.
This is all me. This is all me and my Sam. Scheduling inflexibility this time around. I'm sorry.
100% this is not Mike's fault. It's not really anybody's fault, I don't think, because we were just constantly shifting times and dates.
You know what? We can blame my friend for getting married.
We will blame Sam's friend for getting married.
Yeah.
He or she should have checked with us before they set the date.
How dare they?
This is so rude.
Yes.
So, also from Sam's part of the world comes our first topic, which is kind of a major government thing, right? Like, government weighed in on this and everything. Yeah.
The UK has a real, real problem. In the UK, you'll be driving around and you will see the occasional sign, which will tell you the location of a football stadium. And the government-issued logo for this is a circle.
Uh-huh.
Containing a texture made of hexagons. This is a problem. Would you agree?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely unplayable. If I had to argue about the current status of the UK, this sign represents everything the UK currently struggles with.
I am amazed that there haven't been more traffic incidents because of this.
Exactly, right? How can you possibly find a geometrically impossible football stadium?
Right, exactly.
Geometrically impossible, why, Sam? What does a real football contain?
So, the problem with this...
Air. Lots of air.
If you go to mathsballs.com, that's mathsballs.com, you'll get a full explanation of this, but basically there is a branch of mathematics called tiling, and it is the study of how shapes kind of fit together and the patterns that you can make with them. And if you try and tile hexagons, you will not get a pattern that creates a spherical object, essentially. To do that, you need pentagons.
Right.
And the UK road signs get this wrong. So Matt Parker of Numberphile fame has a petition to the UK government to get this changed. And it's currently up to 22,000 signatures, and it needs 100,000 signatures to be debated by the UK Parliament. And I'm a big Matt Parker fan, and I would love to see this debated in Parliament. This would just make my life. So if you could please go ahead and sign this, it would be splendid.
Now, you must be a British citizen or UK resident to sign the petition, to have the right to sign it.
Darn.
Damn.
I don't know what happens if you sign and... aren't a resident, because it just says the right to sign. Can I just sign it anyway? Because under location, I can choose other countries. Well, of course, because I could be a British citizen that doesn't live in the UK. Right.
True.
I'm not thinking well this morning. It's only noon, so I haven't started thinking yet. And I've been fighting all morning.
Oh, Docker's great.
It's fine.
And
it's fine.
I guess we should also clarify that Mr. Matt Parker has his own YouTube channel called Stand Up Maths, which apparently has over 344,000 subscribers. So he is a Numberphile fame, but he also has his own YouTube channel.
And the government has already responded to this, right? The government has responded saying they're not going to change it.
They have. And it's very, very sad. So Matt Parker is currently doing a bunch of shows in London where they talk about stand-up maths is a really good way of describing what he does. He's a very, very smart guy and he makes mathematics. He's also a programmer. He makes a bunch of these things very accessible through comedy and through a bunch of other kind of comedic experiments. For example, he calculated the ratio of pi using physical pies. There's a video about that on YouTube, which is a lot of fun to watch. But he was doing a bunch of shows and I went to see one of them. He mentioned this maths ball petition that he had. Something that's super striking about Matt Parker to me is he is so humble. And after the show, because he's not mega, mega famous, he's still very accessible in that after a show, you can go up and chat with him. He's a really nice guy. And one of the things he does, and I thought this was great, is he will introduce himself to you before you introduce yourself to him. I really like that. I really like the lack of presumption. It's really nice.
I think we talked about this before I went to Pie Cascades last month, the introducing himself to people thing. And not that I have people coming to shows of mine or whatever, but I tried doing that as I have somewhat of a known name in the Python world. So I tried doing the introducing myself first thing. I don't know if it made any differences or not, but it was kind of a neat way of reversing it. So it was kind of cool, like kind of neat to try that.
Oh, speaking of Pie Cascades, Ken, you should chill really fast. Didn't you give the closing keynote at Pie Cascades?
It was not labeled as closing keynote, but it was the final talk. So, like, the only thing that happened afterwards was closing remarks. So I feel like that's the closing keynote.
Yeah,
and,
I agree.
And one of the organizers, a couple of them actually, like, liked or retweeted my tweet about that. So I think it's official now.
Sounds like endorsement to me. So yeah, if you are interested in watching Ken Love give fascinating talks at great Python conferences, he did give a talk at PyCascades. I don't know if it's up as an individual talk yet. I think they're working on it. But
yeah,
when you get the chance, go watch Ken talk.
As of today, I do believe it's just the recorded live streams that are available. So there's four of those with 2 days of talks. So a morning session and an afternoon session. And they're like 3 to 4 hours long each. So they're pretty long, but it was a really, really great conference. So if you're interested in Python-y things or community things, it was a really great conference. There's even a talk about Rust in there. So
nice.
So one of the things that I saw Matt Parker do on a video, and I think it was from one of his stand-up maths tour occasions, whatever, was he was talking about how modern day images on a screen are made up of red, green, and blue pixels that are aligned next to each other. And, you know, sometimes the red's stronger, sometimes the green's stronger, whatever. And that ends up making all the colors that we see. And you put a bunch of these together and you end up getting what we recognize as an image, right? We've all dealt with that before. Then he brought up the idea that that's basically just a spreadsheet of pixel values. So then he created a program that read an image and found out what the pixel values were, and then turned those into Excel spreadsheet cells. And then when you zoomed the spreadsheet out far enough, it was a picture of him.
Mm.
So pretty cool. He faked a picture inside of a spreadsheet, which is pretty amazing. With that level of technology, though, there's no limit to the things we can do with images, as the first link we have from Dan tells us, because we're now in an era of face swapping apps.
I'll give it like a 6 out of 10 segue score. I don't know. That's the
no.
It seemed a little forced. It seemed a little forced.
That was premium. Premium segue. He knew the area. He knew he linked like previous Matt Parker material to the next topic.
But it seemed a little forced, you know, a little contrived.
You don't know how serious I take this, all right?
It's my second job.
Anyway,
sit at
Dan,
home and watch videos.
Tell us about this. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so in recent weeks, a gentleman by the name of Deepfakes, or I guess it could be a woman, but I believe it's a gentleman. A gentleman by the name of Deepfakes on Reddit has developed I believe it's a convolutional neural network, but I haven't looked at the underlying architecture yet. But it's essentially a machine learning model that when fed essentially a subset of data and a pornographic video will take that data and map the face to the face in the pornographic video. And so, of course, what he's been doing with this is feeding off of the nearly unlimited amount of data we have for pretty much any celebrity in existence, mm-hmm. and mapping it onto pornographic videos.
Hold on. I have to ask, and this is half serious.
Yeah.
Does it need to be a pornographic video?
So no, it doesn't have to, but that's what he originally developed it for, was to generate what are called fakes in the porn community. And so they're essentially they're usually Photoshopped, but you Photoshop the face of a famous actor or actress onto the face of a nude model or whatever. And then you're like, oh, it's a fake from this area or of this actress. But the problem now runs into that, one, these are pretty realistic. And two, you can't do anything about it. So Giphy Cat, the very popular GIF website, has actually started removing these, citing, I think, privacy or something, or copyright infringement. I don't know. But other websites, of course, are not, because they're saying, well, this is no different from Photoshop fakes or anything. But this has now expanded into that the model is now available as a downloadable desktop application in which you insert data from an actor or actress, insert the video you would like it to map to, and it does all of the work and rendering for you.
That's amazing.
And then you just
upload
it. Are
you on commission? Just curious.
I am not on commission, no. But I mean, and so, yeah, that is called Fake App, which I don't know how much of this I want to share, I guess. But yeah, it's called Fake App. So you just download it and you insert data and you get out a video.
And like the closing paragraph of the article that we're linking to mentions, one of the reasons that this works is because there's lots of images of these two sets of people, right? So performers and celebrities. There's tons and tons of imagery for these people out there already. There's also tons and tons of imagery for politicians. So how long before we start, it's probably already happened, but how long before we start to get either the fake porn of politicians or we start to get politicians doing other things outside of that realm that they didn't actually do?
Not too long ago, MIT published a paper on the nature of actually being able to face match in real time with people on a TV screen. And so what ends up happening...
Oh, you think I saw this?
Yeah. I don't know if I've linked it or if you guys have seen this, but you can actually talk, and at the same time, the person on the screen next to you will talk in an identical manner, but it's with their face and their voice. And so there was a person sitting in a chair, and they had a video of George W. Bush on a TV next to them, and this person is saying stuff, and George W. Bush is mimicking the exact facial movements of what this person is doing.
Yeah, I remember seeing
which
that.
Which is... terrifying. So this has already existed. The reason it's getting so much popularity now is because there's already been a lot of discussion surrounding the nature of fakes and of like hacking for images or videos of celebrities, with the whole hacking thing that have happened a couple times now. And so now we run into a very weird ethical and moral area in the sense that, one, these aren't actually videos of the actors and actresses, of course, but two, they look like videos of the actors and actresses. And so it is an interesting situation in that I don't know how people will handle this. So Philip DeFranco did kind of a segment on this, which I think, it really just signal boosted the subreddit. But he spoke about kind of the nature of this application and kind of how we enter a moral and ethical gray area. And there's not really a whole lot actresses or actors can do about it. Because if you're an actor or an actress or someone, a public figure, you end up in a weird situation that, like, a lot of your privacy rights and a lot of your defamation rights are vastly restricted. Because you have to be able to prove a lot of things when it comes to suing for defamation or when it comes to arguing for privacy. And so now we're in a weird place. But yeah, you can definitely make people look like Daisy Ridley or Emma Watson or any number of actresses.
Well, and then tying into all this as well, there is a tool that Adobe demoed recently at Adobe Max, I want to say it was a year or two ago, that can, if you give it a certain sample of people's voice, so of them saying things, you can then cause it to basically manufacture whatever audio you want them to have said. So let's go to where this seems to me to be an obvious end. We take images of politicians, video politicians, map them onto bodies doing things those politicians haven't actually done, and add in audio of those politicians saying things they haven't actually said. And now how does the, you know, layperson determine whether or not a president or a prime minister or a whoever actually did or said the thing that they have evidence of them doing or saying?
Yeah, and I mean, this is kind of along the same vein. Just a couple weeks ago, a gentleman from Berkeley by the name of Carlini published a paper on adversarial examples in the audio space. And you can actually trick audio translations into printing out entirely wrong things using a similar vein to audio adversarial examples with images. So that is another area in which we are now also breaking models now in the audio space in addition to the image space. So yeah, it's been ML is...
Maybe you just need better models.
ML is great. yeah, well, all models are pretty much flawed. There's like 8 papers at ICLR this year, which just got published about defending against adversarial examples, and none of them work. So that's a good thing.
So how are people expected to defend themselves from being faked in any way, shape, or form?
If there's data of you, you really can't.
You gotta wear one of those weird stickers that makes you look like a toaster.
What?
It was an episode or two ago, right? There were stickers that you could place next to a readily identified object, and suddenly the ML would not be able to identify that object anymore. It turned bananas into toasters.
Yeah, it was an example of a physical adversarial example.
I thought you just had a stock of toaster stickers
No.
That you expected me to wrap myself in.
These stickers don't look anything at all like toasters.
No. Ken, shh. Yes, Sam, that is exactly what I have. Yeah. If I sent you some, would you wrap yourself in toaster stickers and take a picture for me?
Yes.
Nice.
The thing is, though, how do you know that I said that? How do you know it's not Adobe
software you're
just
right.
mimicking me? In fact, why are we not using that to just synthesize a mic?
Yeah, that's what we should be. And just make Mike compliment us, like, every single time we say anything. You're right.
Maybe we are currently all synthesized.
Maybe we're all just ML experiments from DeepMind.
So, listen, here's our plan.
What is life?
Here's our plan.
Okay.
We got to do is we got to take our samples of Mike saying stuff from previous episodes, get this Adobe software, and then make him start saying nice things about modern Star Wars movies.
Yes. And then see how long it takes him to notice that everybody who comes up to him is like, wow, you really changed your mind on modern Star Wars movies between episode 8 and episode 9. What? What do you mean? What do you mean I changed my mind? Well, you really started talking great things about Rogue One, about how you really enjoyed the writing and you really enjoyed the effects. And you really enjoyed the cinematography.
I didn't say any of that stuff. Oh, no, but
what?
it's on episode.
I heard that. How's this for some writing and effects?
What?
Stop.
Nice shot, OJ. Plot course to Stujon. It's time to settle things with the Kenobis. If you need me, I'll be checking the reactions to my Last Jedi review on Letterboxd.
What an audacious little sound, throwing his own sounds and disrupting Tylotny's show. Tylotny is the mistress of amplitude and time. It is Tylotny who conceives this soundscape.
Perhaps Tylotny's sounds are their sounds, as the null sound is no one's sounds in all sound.
Horless! This impertinent null wisdom and this copycatting Tylotny's sound throwing will attract other copycatters. Splendid app! Silence! Hush! Sound is singular and faces forward. Splendid app must be singular and never so plural. Splendid app must face forward and speak Tylotny's beautiful tongue if Splendid app is to speak at all.
Come, Tylotny. Splendid app will correct. It is time to clean this mess anyway. You must not punish these voices for playing in your absence.
Oh, the wise Horless dares tell Tylotny she is absent when Tylotny created time and amplitude and waves, and none would exist without Tylotny's cleverness. Tylotny tires of these empty waves. Splendid app may clean up, for he is stupid and may match Horless's wise plans and critical null entertainment.
Horless will return to the void. Honorable Splendid App will put this back on track and may find Horless later.
Por fin solo. En efecto, arreglaré este desastre, pero lo haré a mi manera. Con mis propias y preciosas ondas y lenguaje. Con mi propia visión para el futuro de Wild True FM. Más dilatadora de CD. Más transiciones. Más ganchos para el Patreon. Más chistes de Star Wars. Y más es Hola, Tylotli.
Hola,
Horlis, Horlis. Qué día tan maravilloso, ¿verdad? Los sonidos. Es tan agradable que puede que incluso no tiene forma.
Enjoyed the cinematography.
I didn't say any of that stuff. Oh no, but it's on episode 0010.
Nine.
Well, no, we won't have it done in time for 009. 0009.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, we have to do 0010. Oh, we're gonna go to 00 after this. Wow.
Yeah,
we are. Yeah.
All right. So, yeah. We'll have to apologize if we actually do that to Mike. And Sam,
true, yeah.
You've come out in the past fairly heavily against swap memory. And,
I wouldn't say it was that heavy.
Okay, fine. You've come out in the past saying you don't need swap, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Actually,
no, I think
you've come out pretty aggressively.
Archaic.
Yes, I was about to say, you've been pretty aggressive in your opinion of swap.
I have. It turns out that I was wrong.
Wow.
At least I was wrong in how I was thinking about swap. There was
okay.
a... blog post on Hacker News recently written by somebody called Chris Down, if the domain name is anything to go by.
It probably is.
Called In Defense of Swap. So, previously I have considered swap to be a place that you can put memory that's not in use if you don't have enough physical memory. And this is kind of half true. In Linux systems, you have this concept of main memory, which is typically called RAM. And then you have this concept of secondary memory, which is typically done on disk. And I have been very much in favor of not bothering to do anything with secondary memory, just disabling it, do everything you need with... Yeah, okay. So Dan has just linked to exactly what I said.
I'll read this. Yeah, I'll read this out. Hold on. Sam Hu, I'm on a crusade to disable swap everywhere. It's a relic. It no longer makes any sense.
I mean, you know, that's not that antagonistic, right? He's just
definitely
saying
no
that
aggression.
It needs to be destroyed and burned from the world. That's
and
all.
Disabled.
It's not. Yeah.
In the face of a logical counter argument, I have changed my opinion, and I have no shame in that.
I will also bring up Chris Down here is a fellow Londoner, so you could always go find him and. Tell him how he changed your perception.
I could. I really, yeah, you're not wrong. So the blog post In Defense of Swap, it talks about the way that you should think about this. Instead of having this emergency extra secondary area that you only use when you fill up the primary memory, it's about the reclaimability of memory. So memory being this large contiguous block of bytes is used for different reasons. So parts of memory are used as what's called a page cache or a file cache. And that's like when you read memory from disk, sorry, when you read disk into memory, so a file into memory, the kernel kind of remembers that. And if somebody else reads that file quite soon after, it doesn't do two disk reads. It just keeps that file in memory. And if it hasn't changed, it serves it to the second person that needs it much quicker, which makes a lot of sense. Then there's anonymous memory, and anonymous memory is whenever you call malloc or something like that in your program, you get a chunk of memory that you can use, and this is not backed by a file. So when the kernel comes to need memory, and there's none left, it has to go through a process of reclaiming whatever memory it can, so that it can give new memory out to what needs it. So if you start thinking of files, so files are on disk, and the stuff that you have in memory can be reclaimed, because you can always read that file back into memory. Anonymous memory that programs have requested and stored things in don't have any like durable backing store. They're not on disk, nothing like that, so they just become completely unreclaimable. So in situations where you have quite spiky memory usage, maybe you have a process that's requesting huge blocks of memory, all of your anonymous pages, which I'm led to believe is the majority of RAM, is just not reclaimable at all. So the kernel has to dig into file caches, which the problem here is that there could be anonymously mapped memory that is less used than parts of the file cache. So what you end up doing is evicting parts of the file cache when it would have been better for your efficiency and your performance to swap out some of the anonymous memory. And that's kind of the crux of the argument in the blog post, that swap can really help you in situations where you have tons of anonymous memory, but some of it is just not being used. But you can't swap it out. You can't say that it's reclaimable, right? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I am sorry, swap. I'm sorry. I was wrong. Chris Dan, thank you very much for educating me on the modern uses of swap and why it still matters. I will stop misinforming people.
So, would you say that you're no longer on a crusade to disable swap?
No. Although, I do think that I won't enable swap on any of my machines. I still don't think that I need to kind of go out of my way to enable it. I might if I'm like reinstalling a system or something like that, but for the time being, I'm okay having it disabled. I don't think disabling it is necessarily wrong. But I'm more on board with enabling it now. Like, I understand. The thing that annoyed me a little bit about the blog post, and if I was going to give Chris any feedback, what I would say is there's a striking lack of numbers. It would have been great to see graphs or benchmarks or anything along those lines that showed swap doing its thing. Like, showed swap being really useful in situations that people wouldn't expect.
It sounds like, to a large degree, it's something that is going to be context-dependent. Depending on what you're doing, you may need more swap, you may need less swap, you may need no swap at all. So, like everything else in computer science and technology, it all depends.
It all depends.
It is a trade-off. I think the post mentions that it's heavily workflow-dependent.
Sure, yeah.
I'm pretty sure we don't have swap on any of the servers in my lab, and I definitely don't run it on any of my installations.
Do you have monitoring on the servers in your lab?
Yes. We run Cacti.
It would be sweet if you could try enabling swap and seeing if you have like any notable reduction in CPU or disk usage.
I do not have sudo privileges because I am an undergraduate and our postdoc is the one that gets to run lab machines.
Well, send your postdoc the article and just see what they do.
Be like, hey, postdoc, I just need you to enable swap and then have my PI fire me. That seems like a fantastic route to go down.
Just enable swap for a day. Tomorrow you can disable it and we'll just see what happens.
All right, well, I mean, I'll ask.
Surely none of your experiments run longer than a day.
Yeah, definitely. None of them have ever run longer than a day for anything we do. How did you know?
After a day, you set fire to the computer, right?
Okay, wow. We just hired new sysadmins, actually, because the sysadmin we have, who's brilliant, by the way, Steve, if you ever happen to listen to this podcast, you're a fantastic human being. But so Steve is a PhD student now, but he does mostly research, but he's also like an invaluable member of the lab. He knows all the admin passwords and all the information to our locks, and he does all our installations and everything for CUDA and CUDNN, and invaluable human being, an invaluable human being in the lab. But he's also in like the second year of his PhD and is looking to get out of here in like two more. And so we're trying to find somebody to replace Steve. And of course, one of the first things we do when we hire new sysadmins is show them the burnt out husk of a former server on our table. We're like, hey, this
I'm picturing a job ad posted where it's just like, it's like position Steve.
Yeah. I wish
Steve's your best.
I cannot tell you how invaluable Steve is. Like when the PI of our lab needs information about something or needs help with something related to the servers, the first person he calls is Steve. He's invaluable. Invaluable, Sam.
I'm kind of surprised that like a lab like this has a private investigator. It's just very strange.
I actually have no clue what PI means in this context, but he's just head of the lab. But yeah, he's just head of the lab.
Okay, head of the lab.
So our lab head calls Steve.
Lab head. PI. Yeah, what would PI stand for in that case?
I don't know. Ben knows.
Primary investigator?
I mean, maybe.
I don't know.
Who knows?
Anyway.
Hey, primary investigator.
Primary investigator. Wow. Is that correct?
Hey, what? Ken's a genius. This is why you should go listen to Ken's podcast Gaze Talk, guys. Go right now.
Because I just make up random words and get them right.
I feel like this is a great point to mention that we have our first Patreon reward.
Oh, true. Yes. Yeah.
So we're mentioning Ben. Ben is a great friend of ours. Ben is one of our first Patreons. So thank you so much, Ben. And as like a $5 reward level, we're going to let people join our Discord, join our recordings live, but not be able to say anything. So you can kind of listen in. You can listen into like pre-production recordings.
You get the unedited
version. You can hear us screw everything up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can participate in the conversation as we go along. And you can kind of see what's being said. So thank you so much, Ben. And if anybody else feels like joining in on the old live fun and games.
Patreon.com/WildTrueFM.
Yeah.
Right there.
We'll also mention it in the outro. And it's linked on the website, too. Who'd have thought?
All of these things. Speaking of the website, we should have a host page up sometime soon, because I still don't think we have that.
Oh, yeah. Live. I don't.
We also need a Patreon's kind of
We've got lots of things
page.
We need to do. We will do those, though.
Anyway, so we have Steve. And Steve is fantastic. And I'm giving Steve a shout-out, because he has interviews with Twitter and Apple coming up soon. And I think he's going to crush them out. So hopefully ends up doing ML work for Twitter or Apple summer.
Why don't we just send this episode to Twitter and Apple and let them find out how good Steve is? No, I promise. Just listen 30 minutes in. It'll be fine. You'll find out.
Yeah, let me just tweet at somebody. Be like, hey, I come from a small podcast with no poll, but you should listen to this.
You should listen to this podcast.
Yeah, you should listen to it and then share it with everybody at your company in like a company-wide email. That would be fantastic.
It's very important to something that you're doing right now.
Yes. Speaking of things that are very important, I would like to talk about Minecraft.
And you give me crap for my segue.
Hey, I feel like Minecraft is a little bit more important than this joke suggests that it is.
Oh, well.
But I can talk about that later.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Minecraft represents a pretty substantial change in the way that we approached gaming. Because everybody had been trying to build the biggest and best. And now, for like, actually, you can just build 8-pixel blocks and sell your company for $2 billion and then become a raging lunatic on Twitter.
Right, but remember, Minecraft represents the limit of Notch's programming ability, which isn't saying much.
And it's in Java.
The Java version
is Kenneth,
terrible.
Mr. Kenneth, you had given us a YouTube playlist to watch regarding the nature of somebody who has never played Minecraft nor watched any playthroughs of Minecraft in the last 10 years.
We'll say 10. I don't know exactly when Minecraft came out, but it seems like 10 years is a pretty good guess, right? Like 2008, 2009 probably was when it came out. Anyway, so yeah, this...
Sam and I are both checking. You're
yes, please. Please go look that up for me. So...
2009, May 17th, 2009.
Look at
you were darn close.
Man.
I'm impressed. This is why you should go listen to Ken's
talk. That was a few months before I joined university. I'd like to think that is a handicap to my education.
Minecraft?
Let's see, May 2009, that was one day...
Yeah, I was 15. I couldn't even drive yet.
That was one day after I turned 28? Yeah.
I couldn't drive yet.
All right.
I was not allowed to legally operate motor vehicles.
Anyway, this playlist is from a YouTuber. I want to say the name is Piropito. P-I-R-O-P-I-T-O. It's a Japanese man. The recordings are all in Japanese, but there are English subtitles that are hard-coded to the video. And yeah, apparently he has never played Minecraft before. He's not watched anyone play Minecraft. He's not read the Minecraft wiki or any of the, like, how to play books or nothing. So he has gone into Minecraft blind, and he's just trying to discover it through the game mechanics. So he's not, as he's playing, he's not looking at the wiki, he's not watching other playthroughs, he's not asking people for help, anything like that. So my oldest son and I have been watching these. They're really short. They start off at like 15 minutes long, and then they drop down to about 6 minutes towards the end. He's done 70 or so of these things so far, and it's amazing to watch someone try to play the game that we all think of as this, like, crafting and discovery game, and be very, very hamstrung by how much is undiscoverable purely through game mechanics.
I think I speak for everybody when I ask if you can do us a solid and just link to the first episode he finds a creeper.
Yes. Yeah, it's pretty early on. It's one of my favorite things about this. He doesn't know they're called creepers, because nothing identifies what they are. What anything is until it kills you, and I guess he just hasn't read those messages. So he calls them cactuses, which I think is just the most amazing cute thing ever. So I've stopped calling them creepers myself. They're now cactuses.
Nice.
But yeah,
floating cactuses.
It's things like trying to figure out what makes an Enderman mad, right? Like if you played the game for a while, you've learned that if you look them in the face, they get angry at you. They're the only creature that does that. So when you're coming across any other mob in the game, you have no way of knowing if they're going to attack you or not, if they become aggressive based on a certain action. For instance, when he first goes to the Nether and sees all these zombie pigmen, they look like zombies. He's been killing zombies in the overworld, so what does he do? He attacks and promptly dies, because that's what happens when you attack zombie pigmen. The first video of his I watched was later on in the series, and it was the one where I was first like, holy crap, this is an amazing like course in what not to do in game design. So he's looking through, it was Minecraft 1.10, 1.11, added in these advancements in the in one of the in-game menus where you can see all these like predefined things for you to do in the game. I know they existed before as achievements. They were harder to find then. The advancements menu made it a lot easier to find them and kind of gave them like a progression. So one of them is like, go to the Nether. So how do you go to the Nether? Nothing in the game tells you how to make a Nether portal, and there are no other generated structures in the game that have the same size and shape as a Nether portal. And The Japanese translation apparently was ambiguous. It could have been read as craft a Nether portal and not build a Nether portal. So he was trying to do it on the crafting table, which is impossible.
Yeah.
So eventually he figures it out. He goes through 4 or 5 stacks of obsidian, building these different versions and all these different sizes. And he gets like super close so many times, but he's off by like a block. And you're just like, oh man, you could have had it if you just not put that block there.
I bet that hurts to watch.
Yeah, I was about to say, I'm sitting here just getting frustrated thinking about
it.
Several stacks of obsidian, that takes forever to mine.
Yeah.
Holy moly.
Yeah. Dude is dedicated. At the point I'm at, he has not yet learned that holding down shift prevents you from falling off of a full block height.
Oh.
And he has built a multi-thousand block long bridge in the air by inching his way up to the edge of a block, turning around, placing a new one. And, you know, just to make this clear, this is nothing against this guy playing. This guy is playing as best as he possibly can. It's that the game has absolutely no teaching mechanic to it. There's no way inside Minecraft to learn how to play Minecraft, which is a giant mistake.
Do you feel like there are certain subsets of games that maybe should have that approach, that are maybe more brutal in their approach to the player and are marketed as such, like a Dark Souls,
I don't think brutal is the same thing. I know what you're getting at, but Minecraft and Dark Souls, they're punishing the user, I think, in different ways. I think Dark Souls is intentionally really hard, whereas Minecraft is...
But Dark Souls...
lazy in teaching the user what
Dark Souls teaches you everything you need to know to play Dark Souls.
Or not to play Dark Souls.
Or not to play Dark Souls if you end up not liking it. Yeah. But the first level of every Dark Souls game is set up with progressively harder enemies where you have to learn to do different things. You have to learn how to hit the enemy. You have to learn not to get too close to them. You have to learn how to kite them. You have to learn to block with your shield if you have one. You may have to learn how to parry or riposte, depending on the weapon that you have, right? So Dark Souls does a really good job in that first level of teaching you how to play Dark Souls. Dark Souls follows the Super Mario Brothers scheme, which if you can remember back to the first time you ever played Super Mario Brothers, you start off on the far left side of the screen. It's wide open to the right of you, which teaches you to move right, that's the direction every level is going to go. And then you come across enemies. And if you remember correctly, you only have 2 buttons. You very quickly figure out which is the jump button. And, you eventually figure out, it may not be right away, but you eventually figure out that touching enemies will kill you, and you jump on enemies to kill them. And then you've learned everything you need to know to play Super Mario Brothers. Yeah, there's other little tricks like getting a fire flower or the invincibility star or whatever, but you've learned everything you need to know to actually play the game. In Minecraft, you spawn on the edge of a body of water, and that's it. It doesn't tell you that you have to cut down trees to get wood to make tools. It doesn't tell you that you have to create a bench. It doesn't tell you you have to turn wood into log or into planks. Like, none of that comes out in the game. Where we're currently at watching the videos, we're around episode 30 or 40. He's been struggling to figure out how redstone works.
Oh, man.
Oh, God. Yeah.
So, I mean, Redstone borrows a whole lot from electrical engineering, right? There's all these gates and all these kinds of things that you can build. I mean, he's literally struggling with, like, make a redstone lamp, put a lever on it, turn the lever on. Because that's not obvious in the game. So it's been very interesting.
You think it's difficult in different ways. You think one is intentionally difficult but marketed as such, and the other is simply does a lazy job of teaching the user how to play.
Between like Dark Souls and Minecraft?
Dark Souls is intentionally obtusely difficult. I mean, the point of the game is to just be incredibly frustrating, but to be rewarding in a sense when you finally beat something. Whereas you think Minecraft is just bad at teaching you how to play, and thus you don't have access for the game being difficult. It's just...
Right, so
you don't know how to play it.
The access to Dark Souls is very low level, right? These are what the buttons do. In that first level, there are always signs left by the developers of the game that will teach you how to play the game. This button does this, this button does that, here's how you dodge, here's how you attack, whatever, right? The difficulty in Dark Souls is that the areas get progressively harder as far as the number of enemies they have in them or the tactics you have to use on those enemies, right? This enemy requires you to parry or riposte if you ever want to hit them. This is a mob of 10 enemies that are going to come at you at once. How do you draw out one at a time? Those are the challenges in Dark Souls. Or Dark Souls-like games, right? So Nioh or whatever else. Whatever that one is.
Nioh.
All of the mechanics of the game are revealed to you very early on, and the challenge is literally just playing the game. It's a hard game to play. You have to have the knowledge to do these certain things, right? From Minecraft, playing the game is very easy, but there's absolutely nothing that reveals the mechanics of the game to you.
So, along that point, so our beloved Patreon Ben has pointed out in chat that we need to play The Witness and Subnautica. Now, I've never played either of these games, but the reason that he has suggested this is because they do a really good job of teaching you how to play without necessarily telling you how to play. And there are a bunch of games that do this quite well. So, Journey, for example, the game called Journey, does an amazing job of this. It does kind of tell you some of the buttons at the very start, but there are a whole swathe of games that have this first section of the game where you are playing the game, the story is happening, but through the first 10 minutes or so of play, it subtly teaches you how to do everything along the way. For example, Horizon Zero Dawn, released last year, is a good example of this. Like, the first section of the game, you are being taught by your mentor the dangers of the world and how you deal with certain enemy types. And it's part of the story, but it is a tutorial. But it's not like you walk into this area where it says tutorial in big black letters and it's not in your face like that. But that's a section of games that I typically really enjoy. I really enjoy when I pick up a new game thinking, like, how is it going to teach me? And if it does a really good job of teaching me, it sets a really great first impression of the game.
I feel like I remember Subnautica actually being fairly explicit with teaching you how to play. I felt like
I want to say it is in the very beginning, yeah.
Yeah, I felt like it was fairly explicit. Like, this is what you need to be doing, and this is how you craft stuff, and this is how you find necessary materials. Like, what biomes to go to, where you could find the materials in that biome.
On that note, though, they did just release their 1.0 final, so that may have changed.
Yeah, I haven't played it since beta, and so it could have changed. I will vouch for Subnautica, though, and say that it's a fantastic game. Of all the games that you should be looking at recently, I think Subnautica should definitely be on your list if you're into, like, a Minecraft / Roblox or whatever style game.
Well, and then...
Have you played The Witness?
I have not had a chance to play The Witness, no.
Yeah, I've got that one, but I think my son's played it, and he got stuck somewhere near the end, but...
I'm currently playing Black Desert Online, so I've been sucked into MMO land for the time being.
So, another option, one of my absolute favorite games is RimWorld. I'm approaching 500 hours played on it on Steam.
Holy moly.
So obviously I like this game.
I was about to say.
The first time you play it, you have two options. There is literally a tutorial story, like, scenario that you can work through where it's telling you what to do. And it's sending you events and, you know, goodies along the way so that you can do the things it's telling you to do. Or if you don't want to do that, you just want to actually start playing the game. You know, you can spawn your own world and your own colonists and everything and start playing. And up in the upper right-hand corner, there's a... teaching guide, learning guide, I can't remember exactly what it's called. But basically it just breaks down, here's the things that are going to happen to you in the first couple of hours of playing the game. And the things you need to know. So, okay, hey, you've got your colonists. You should probably set up places for them to sow plants so that you'll have food coming in. You should set up a place to butcher animals and cook food. You should set up beds. You should set up, you know, defenses. And by the time you get through all the topics that the learning helper thing brings up, you know how to play basically everything in the game. The only thing you're going to get surprised by will be like, oh, who thought a manhunting pack of 20 rabbits would kill my entire colony? But that's part of the fun of the game.
I actually played RimWorld recently on your recommendation.
And?
So something I think an important point that you missed that I thought was fantastic was rather than having like an explicit difficulty setting, the game asks you.
Yes.
And it gives you some options about the narrator that you can use. I think they call it the narrator.
Storyteller, I want to say. But yeah.
That was it. And it says this person will occasionally trigger quite tricky events, but in general will be quite easygoing on you. Then this other person will be really brutal and it's going to be a real challenge if you pick this storyteller. And I thought that was nice. That was a nice, instead of rather choosing like easy, normal, hard, demonic, or
an
whatever.
An extra nice touch to that is in the middle of your game at any time you want, you can change which storyteller and the difficulty of that storyteller. So you can start off super easy because I want to figure out how to play this game, right? I want to see what's going on. And then a couple of hours in, you've got everything set up. You're feeling good about yourself. You can make that storyteller harder, or you can switch to a different storyteller that you know is going to be more aggressive. Or you can do both of those things at the same time, which is a nice feature.
Yeah. And then there's another model that I quite like where in if you've played Civilization or Stellaris, two quite similar games, they ask you during the game, it's like, do you know this game well? Have you played a previous version of this game? Like how many tips and hints and things like that do you want us to give you? And I think that's quite nice. It's nice to be able to say, I am new to this game, please help me.
I've really enjoyed games such as Eve or Elite Dangerous, where less than having like a defined tutorial, you end up spawning into the world and then they have a series of like tutorial tasks.
Right.
Where it's like, go out and do this and kind of learn stuff as you go. So it gets you both playing the game in like the real sense, and then also accomplishing tutorial tasks alongside of it. And so I've enjoyed that tutorial model. However, I've also been playing games since I was like 9. And so for me, a tutorial model that's a little more hands-off and is like, you can either do these tutorials or just kind of go do your own thing is the route I prefer, just because I have a lot of gaming years. Too many.
I did that with the newest Mario game, Mario Odyssey. I kind of went ahead with it. I started playing. I realized, oh, this button throws your hat. This is how you jump. This is all very adorable. I'm loving this. And then I was kind of struggling on a part of it, and a friend of mine was visiting from out of town, and he was watching me do this, and he's like, why don't you ever leave your hat spinning and then jump on it? And I was like,
what? You can do that?
What? That's amazing. I didn't even know you could do that. And then I kind of realized, oh, I've struggled on some parts of this completely unnecessarily.
Right, this would have been so much easier had I known that mechanic. Yeah.
Yeah, and I only really have myself to blame because there is a section that tells you all the different movements and jumps and things that you can do, and I just thought, nah.
Yeah, but that...
do away
with
the manual.
That's like how, you know, Mortal Kombat or Street Fighter always had an area where, like, you could pause and go read through all the moves your character could do, but no one did that because you'd rather be fighting and just hitting buttons and seeing what happens. I think we're all in agreement, though, that Minecraft does a terrible job of teaching you how to play Minecraft.
Yes.
But yeah, I will definitely put a link in to Pierpito's first episode, so that people can start from the beginning. Because it's absolutely amazing watching this person work through a modern game with absolutely zero hand-holding. It's like 20 episodes in before he discovers a bed exists and that you can sleep in it at night and it will respawn you there. He dies so many times before he ever gets a bed. So many times.
I feel bad for this guy, but also impressed. Since we're wrapping up this topic, if anyone is interested in ML like I am, Netflix now has the AlphaGo documentary available on their website. So if you're interested in watching a documentary on AlphaGo, the famous deep learning model that beat Lee Sedol in Go in March of 2016, you can go to Netflix and now watch a documentary on it, which I found particularly fascinating because I'm a giant nerd and I watched it at 12:30 in the morning. And it was great.
Exactly how many times have you watched it?
I'm at twice now, but my girlfriend fell asleep while watching it the second time, so I'll have to watch it the third. I'm a little afraid that this is going to turn into like the Social Network style thing where I just like watch it on a regular basis because I find it fascinating, but I don't know yet. We have time. But I got to introduce to Demis Hassabis, who seems like an interesting individual, kind of his team and the nature of how they went about building this and how all of this stuff is made. So great stuff. So yeah, that's my plug for Netflix's new content. Like they needed plugs for content on their website.
Well, and by watching content on Netflix, you're also helping their machine learning algorithms figure out what to recommend to people. You're doing ML work by watching movies.
For free.
Oh man, that reminds me. Did you see the newest CGP Grey video?
Which one?
The one about how machines learn.
Yes, I did. He did a semi-okay job of explaining stuff.
I really liked it. From what I understand of how machines learn and what I understand of CGP Grey, I feel like he did a good job of making it pretty accessible.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing you run into, and it's another thing, this guy named Greg Brockman sent out a tweet. He's the co-founder and CTO of OpenAI. And he mentioned about how easy ML is to learn. He said, it's very easy to get into machine learning these days. And it confused me because I have never met an ML researcher who looks at the mathematics that we do or the implementations that we make and goes, you know what? ML is easy. And then when people talk about like, yeah, they made ML very accessible. And then I compare it with this guy saying that ML is easy. And I'm like, accessible things usually don't have to be called easy, or usually don't call easy things accessible because they're kind of naturally accessible. But I would not argue that ML is easy. But Greg Brockman also dropped out of MIT to go become the CTO of Stripe and built it from a 4-person company to a 250-person company. So his easy is relative. And Ken and I already had a discussion on the nature of easy being relative. So
that said, you recommended that I read, so I only know it as the acronym, the ISLR book. I can't remember what the actual thing stands for. Help me out.
Introduction to Statistical Learning in R. Yes.
Yeah. And this book, if you have a high school, maybe, or AP level understanding of mathematics, so far, this seems to be a really nice kind of bottom-up approach to how a lot of the concepts that you will need to understand machine learning work and fit together. And I've been super enjoying reading this book.
Yes. So the only thing you run into is that a lot of times what is recommended is ESL, or Elements of Statistical Learning. And ESL is like a pit of lava. And if you don't have a background in math, you kind of just get chucked into this pit of lava to figure out. If you have a background in math, it's more like a bridge over this pit of lava. But if you don't have a background in math, you just kind of get chucked in. Whereas ISL, even with a minor background in math or no background in math at all, is a much more gradual step up to where ESL is at. So I meet a lot of people that are interested in ML but don't have a background in math. And I always say, start with ISL. It's only like 400 pages. And then move into ESL and the deep learning book and stuff like that. The funny thing,
I do feel like you should have probably listened in math class in school if you want to take on ISLR, because it's been somewhere in the region of 10 years since I did mathematics academically, and I'm having to read this book pretty slow. There's a lot of notation and a lot of, the author defines the terms and things that they're going to use throughout the book and doesn't do a lot of like reinforcement of what that means. So there's a lot of terms where I found myself having to flick back and go, what did X sub I mean? I've completely forgotten. And things like that. And there's a lot of mathematical notation, which typically scares me. And I have to look at it 4 or 5 times, read through it very slowly to understand it, because it's not something that comes naturally to me. So definitely, if you find yourself reading this book and you're like, whoa, this is more maths than I was intending, take it slow. Just try not to read past something in the hope it will make sense later, because that has not as yet worked out for me. I feel like going back and rereading until it makes sense works a lot better.
The funny thing that I always explain to people, because I'm reading through the book called The Deep Learning Book right now by Goodfellow et al., I believe. And there's a section in the book where we're talking about Jacobian and Hessian matrices, which are essentially matrices of derivatives. And the first page in the paragraph, it says, sometimes, though, we would like the derivative of the derivative. This is called the second derivative. And you're like, oh, okay. And then you turn the page, and it's like a very complex mathematical equation for the second derivative of this machine learning algorithm. And it's called the Hessian matrix, and it goes through how to find this calculation. And so machine learning and deep learning and stats and that whole shebang has a tendency to ramp up very quickly, and it just amused me, the dichotomy between this is the second derivative and this is the very complicated algorithm to figure out the second derivative of a given input. And you're like, oh, okay. All right. This is some complicated math. So yeah, I just wanted to bring up the new AlphaGo, and I'm glad you're enjoying ISLR, Sam, because I found that book very helpful.
Yeah, thank you for the recommendation.
I'll also bring up that Crash Course, the people who do the YouTube series that will explore a topic, kind of teach a topic, has just started doing a statistics course on there. So they just finished up Crash Course Computing, which was wonderful, and then they just now started Crash Course Statistics. So if you want something super easy to approach, I highly recommend them. I love Crash Course. They do amazing stuff.
Did I tell you I applied to be the host of the computer science courses?
Did you really?
You lost out to a very worthy host.
I did. Yeah, I haven't watched them yet because, you know, I'm pretty salty about that.
Yeah, I was about to say.
I would have loved it.
Loved it.
I love Crash Course. I loved the Crash Course World History. I think that was the original one they did. It was so enjoyable.
As long as we're on the topic of YouTube videos that teach ML, 3 Blue, 1 Brown, which is a fantastic YouTube channel, also does a background in ML. I love 3 Blue, 1 Brown. He's kind of mathematically intense. I'm pretty sure he's a Stanford PhD, so just be aware of that. But yeah, I've really enjoyed his series on machine learning and kind of how they end up in the place that it does and some of his visualizations. So, all right, that's it for ML, I promise. I just want to talk about AlphaGo. I've only watched it twice. I will have to watch it a third time, but it's okay.
Yeah, we promise all of the... We've gone over a lot of different YouTube channels and books and stuff. All of these links will be in the show notes.
Yep.
If you want to find out more or explore them or go and watch stuff, then yeah, check out the show notes. They will be
there. Mike has to do them, and since he skipped, it seems fair.
Right. But that's all our show for today.
On that note...
That's our show for today. Thank you all so much for listening. We'd love to hear any feedback or suggestions you might have for us. We'd also love, you know, a review or a rating on like iTunes or wherever you happen to enjoy podcasts. You can find us on Twitter as WildTrueFM. Our site, WildTrue.fm, has all of our show notes for the episode that you just listened to and all the other ones. It also has links to our GitHub, our Patreon, and, you know, that's basically it for now. But there'll be more eventually. Hosts are coming. Patreon supporters are coming. Fake images of Dan are coming. All sorts of stuff. If you find a problem with an episode, show notes, the site, whatever, you can open up a issue with us on GitHub, and we will take care of that as soon as we possibly can. And if you would like to support the creation of this show, especially Mike doing the amazing editing job that he does, please check out our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/wildtruefm, and consider becoming a supporter. For $5, you can listen in while we record this. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next time.